Hey, what's going on? I'm Blaine Lay, and you're listening to Two People. It's a podcast about Richmond. In each episode on the show, we talk to someone from around town about who they are as a person and how that comes to life in the work they do. If you've listened to the show before, yes, we took a little bit of a break there over the summer, but we're back, and we'll be rolling out some new episodes coming at you this fall. Today on the show, I sit down with John Beliles. He's a longtime Richmonder, and he currently serves on city council and is running for mayor. I talk with John about what it was like growing up in Richmond in a family committed to public service. His dad was the governor. We talk about the street art festival that he helped to found and about how that came to life. I also ask him about what motivated him to run for office, and we talk through some of the issues facing the city with an eye for what he'd do as mayor to address some of them. And at the end, I run him through a quick Q&A. John has a great head of hair, and among other things, I ask him whether that's natural or if he uses product. This is episode 23 with Councilman and mayoral candidate John Beliles. You're listening to Two People. All right. Councilman John Beliles, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
How are you doing today?
Doing well, thanks.
You're running for mayor, so you're knocking on a lot of doors and talking to a lot of folks.
I am. I was over in this neighborhood a couple of weeks ago.
Gotcha. We're on the north side right now as we record. It's a beautiful day. So, John, I want to start at the beginning and just hear a little bit about you as a guy. Like, you are both Councilman Beliles, but you're also a guy named John. You were born and raised in Richmond. What were some of your formative years like here?
Well, Richmond has always been my home, and it's always been the place that I want to be. I've loved the city ever since I was a kid, even when I didn't know why. I was very passionate and defensive about Richmond when, you know, we went through some tough times in the 80s and, you know, early and mid 90s. And I would always tell people, you know, you just don't know the Richmond that I know.
Right.
I know what Richmond can be. It's just, we're not there yet. You know, it was, you know, you go off to college or you travel places and you tell people you're from Richmond, and 20 years ago they were, where? Right. Richmond, Virginia. Oh, yeah, I've heard of it.
The Richmond.
Right. And now it's, yeah, there are a handful of Richmonds across the country, Indiana, California, places like that. But I think we've evolved into being Richmond.
Because I'm thinking back like 10, 20 years ago in like the late 80s, early 90s, what was the conception of Richmond if someone did know about it? Like, when you say you were defensive about it, what were the things that you would have to defend at that point in time?
Well, they were things that were true. I mean, they were, it was dangerous, very high crime. We had a lot of drug problems. You know, there were a lot of things that just happened to be true. But my belief in the city was that one day, you know, we could realize our potential and rise above where we were back then. Now, don't get me wrong, I had zero inclination of being part of that as, mm-hmm. as a government official, but always as somebody who would cheerlead for Richmond and try and make it better. And that started, you know, when I was in my late 20s, I bought a house in the Museum District where I still live and started getting involved in the Neighborhood Association. And that led to starting a blog in 2004 called River City Rapids.
Uh-huh.
Talked a lot about what was going on in Richmond, this from the school system to, you know, Mayor Wilder coming in trying to change the culture at City Hall and get people involved. You know, the things like the downtown master plan. There were there was a group of us, John Murden, Ross Catro, John Sarvey, you know, we were all blogging.
It was like the early days of the blogosphere.
It was when blogging was cool, you know, back in the day. And we all kind of rose to the occasion to get people invested. And it was the way I describe it is, you know, back then Richmond was learning to crawl, and now we are walking briskly,
right?
And we have a chance to break into a sprint, or we have a chance to trip on the sidewalk and break our ankle,
right?
And that's what I think this year is all about, quite frankly.
Your father and your family was also involved in public service for most of your life. Your dad, Jerry Beliles, he was in the House of Delegates. He was the Attorney General. He was the governor. How did growing up with a father in the public sphere shape the way that you see things? How did that form you?
Well, it made for some interesting dinner conversations because, mm-hmm. you know, you'd come home and you would talk about, you would watch the news at 6:30 while you were eating, and then you would talk about politics, or dad would be on the phone, or mom would be doing her thing. And she was on a ton of boards and very involved in the education and literacy and in the arts community in Richmond for decades. And that's just kind of how we were raised. You know, my dad got elected to the House of Delegates on my 5th birthday. And one of my first memories is having about 500 people in our backyard at this huge victory party. Mm-hmm. And it was total bedlam, and it was a lot of fun. But that's kind of when politics came into my life.
Right.
And, you know, we had an interesting childhood, like I said, but you know, we would have to go on trips with our parents to cookouts and picnics and, you know, get in the car and behave at the picnic and all that stuff. And it's very different from growing up today, I think. And, you know, also later when he became governor, you know, you had to be careful and, you know, recognize that your father was a statewide official, and anything that you did would reflect poorly on the family. So
did you have security back then? This is just such a fascinating world to me.
I mean, my mom and dad did, but we didn't.
Did you ever, what is an example as a mayoral candidate that you could share? Like, did you have like a rebellious period where you would things?
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, you know, all teenagers do. I was 15 when he got elected. So, you know, I was 10 when he, or 11 when he got elected attorney general, and 15 when he got elected governor. So, yeah, it was an interesting time. I mean, you had to be careful, but you know, we would do all this stupid stuff that teenagers do.
Yeah, I guess you're just lucky it wasn't in the age of Twitter where that would be
YouTube,
all over everywhere.
Exactly.
John Beliles. So I want to ask about just your educational background. You went to UVA, studied foreign affairs, got your master's at George Mason. How did your time at UVA and or George Mason, either in the classroom or outside of it, just shape who you are today?
Well, I think one of the great things about UVA was the diversity of the students and the offerings. I mean, there wasn't anything that you couldn't learn or take a class about at UVA. And so I used those years to meet a lot of new people, people that I'm still friends with that live all over the country, as well as, you know, broaden my horizons educationally.
So I want to ask about the Street Art Festival. I think you might be the czar of street art in Richmond. You can make the case for Ed Trask, probably.
I would definitely make the case for Ed Trask.
Maybe you're co-czars, co-street art czars.
I'm the prince, he's the king.
Okay, I'll accept that. How did the street art get started? How did the Street Art Festival get started, and why did it come about?
It's interesting origin. I was in Venice in 2009, and I was walking through St. Mark's Square with a woman that I was going out with at the time, and she said, "Hey, what's going on over here?" And there was this wall set up in the square, and there were a bunch of people around it, and you could tell that there was something going on painting-wise. And she's like, "Let's go check it out." And I'm like, "Really? Come on. We just got to Venice, you know." And so we walked over there, and it just happened to be Shepard Fairey from L.A.
Oh, yeah.
And he had been hired by the city of Venice to come over and do a bunch of murals in different squares around Venice. And he was in St. Mark's Square that day. So, you know, the guy that didn't want to go over there, 2 hours later, I'm still standing there just gawking at this project going on. And it wasn't a huge mural, but what struck me was he had a couple of people with him. They were creating a mural and we were standing there, and I thought he was going to go a certain way with the mural, and he didn't.
As he was painting it?
As he was doing it.
Wow, okay.
And so I envisioned in my mind what he was thinking, but in reality it was in his mind. And so I couldn't figure out why he was doing what he was doing, but the great thing was is after he was done, he would hang out and talk to people. And he would interact. He would take breaks and step back. And, you know, that was right after I got my first iPhone, so I didn't know who he was. So while he was sitting there, I'm looking it up on my iPhone. Oh, okay, this is, I know who this guy, I've heard of him. but I didn't know who he was.
Because he did the Obama poster, exactly. Right? So that would have been the
year
shortly thereafter.
This was a year after that.
Yeah.
So anyway, we got to watch him create a mural and then ask him about it. You know, and when you go to a museum, you see all kinds of fantastic art, some that moves you, some that doesn't. But you don't get, don't get to ask the artist what they were thinking when they were putting it together. So they were in town the same time we were. And so we saw them in a different square a couple days later and a couple days later. And so we, were able to talk to them at each of the places. And so anyway, I just thought that was fascinating. And I can't draw stick figures, so I, but I can appreciate art. And so I thought that was a really neat thing. And then 2 years later, when I was in planning and development, we did a community project. We were part of a community project with Altria and some other groups doing a cleanup. And part of the project was Ed Trask and Chris Milk created a bunch of murals for volunteers to paint. And they just basically did a paint by numbers.
Right.
And so about a week or so after that project, I saw Ed down at Concord Public sitting out on the deck. And I just walked up to him and I said, "Hey, I'm John Belisles. We met, we worked together on the Altria project." He's like, "Oh yeah, how you doing?" And so I said, you have a minute? I want to sit down and pitch an idea to you." And I sat down and told him, and he was like, "Love it. Let's do it." And the interesting thing about how that got started was, we sat down and I gave him my pitch. The festival that came out 8 months later, 9 months later, looked nothing like what I sat down and talked to Ed back about. So I had an idea, and this goes to this will go to the political part of this discussion. You have to recognize sometimes that your idea may not always be the best one. Mm-hmm. And what Ed and I did and Chris did was we sat down with people like Emily Davis, other guy, BJ Cosin, some volunteer groups. Venture Richmond was very helpful. And we kind of morphed my idea into something which became the RVA Street Art Festival. So I planted the seed,
right?
But the fruit was very different.
Well, that's interesting when you get people around the table.
Exactly.
And I think related, when you get the right voices around the table, and I would say like a diversity of like different ways of thinking about it, that you can be iterative and strengthen the idea if folks aren't beholden to my idea, but how can we listen and build together something collaborative?
And it's exactly right. And I mean, if I had stood in that room and jumped up and down and said, no, this is my idea. I don't want it to change.
I'm the czar. Right.
A lot of those people probably would have found something better to do with their time.
And it's part, I think even if right out of the gate, you would come up with the right solution, I think that there's a benefit of the process of involving other people because they also have ownership in what the thing will actually become.
Absolutely, completely. And, the first street art festival in 2012, it was essentially, Ed and I working out of the trunks of our cars that weekend. And then, the one at GRTC and then the one we just did at Manchester, we knew we were going to need help. And so we built a good team. So we have a core team now that is kind of like that. They're the brain trust of the group, and they know things, and everybody's got their responsibilities as far as, okay, you're in charge of talking to these people and these. And so it's grown, and we're actually working on establishing ourselves as a 501c3 now.
Oh, cool.
So we're slowly taking it to the next level.
Awesome. Great things. It's an asset for the city for sure.
Yeah. It's people ask me, what's your proudest accomplishment, and certainly my proudest personal accomplishment is the RVA Street Art Festival. I think as hard as we worked in 2012 to get elected to council and all the people that helped me get there, that's a great accomplishment. But I think the RVA Street Art Festival, because of its endurance, is going to have a good lasting legacy.
And is the festival at GRTC or in Manchester, is that separate from the mural project?
It is. It is. And the mural project's run by a gentleman out of Washington. And Ed and I, the first street art festival, we kind of wanted to show that street art is okay. You know, right. it wasn't graffiti anymore like it was when Ed first got here at VCU back in the 90s. And we also wanted people. The reason we created a festival is that's probably the biggest part of my initial idea that remained, was that people can come on one day and see where it's starting,
right,
and come back the next day and see where it's going, and then they can come back the third day and see how it finishes.
It's about
up.
The process. Yeah,
exactly. So we didn't want, I mean, some of the art that's come to town in the mural project is phenomenal, you know, these great international artists, but again, it's like going to a museum. You don't get to ask him what he's doing. Right. And that was one of the reasons why we wanted a festival. It's also, you know, the goal is, one of the goals, obviously, is to, you know, find local artists, but also raise arts or money for arts education for children. And then, you know, all three locations that we had done for the festivals have been in the spirit of rejuvenating blighted properties.
Right. Yep. I want to ask one quick question on sort of your view of the role of public art, because there's been a conversation going on, right, where you've got one is the bounded view, I would say, where it's let's be smart about what we put up. We need to have some standards. Mark Holmberg has written on this. And then I think the other view is more of the open view, where it's really about unfettered self-expression. And I'm curious how you think about the role of public art. Should we have standards? Should it be unfettered? How do you think about that as someone that's passionate about something like this?
Well, I don't, you're talking about standards as far as limiting art, or standards as far as where it can go? Because I remember during the first street art festival, there was a committee that reviews anything that is put up on or near the canal walk. And so we had a discussion with the people on that committee, and they wanted the artists that were coming to submit the art beforehand. And Ed and I, especially Ed, were like, look, these people aren't coming to paint propaganda or political stuff. You know, they're going to have a theme, which is, okay, we're right on the river, canal, the industrial nature of that building, which used to produce streetcars. And the streetcars would come in, and there was hydroelectric power. And so all of that was discussed, sometimes intensely. And we won out because Ed convinced them that, you know, these artists aren't going to do anything that's going to embarrass you or Richmond or the canal walk. And we were right. I mean, Ed knew all of them.
Right.
And
right.
So, you know, here's our theme, run with it, have fun, and look at it now. I mean, people still are down there every day taking pictures in front of murals and stuff like that. So, yeah. As far as standards go, I don't think there should be standards on what somebody can paint, but if, I think public art's important in any form. So I don't know how we would limit it, but you know, I'm open to discussion. Yeah. Again, it's kind of like how the festival was born. Somebody has an idea, let's put it on the table and get some people in the room and talk about it.
Yeah. One quick question. The last time I saw you at the festival, you were in a hat, you were in cargo shorts, you're out walking around in your tennis shoes. It was a Sunday morning, and you were talking to Tim Kaine. I was like, oh, that's cool. Just two local guys hanging out.
Right.
And I just thought that was so great that A, he was there, but B, just that you guys were hanging out at the street art festival. And what's your relationship been like with him?
It's been great. You know, I wasn't really tuned in a whole lot in the time that he was on council in the mid 90s. I was, you know, I really didn't start tuning in until I started getting involved in my neighborhood association in the late 90s, early 2000s. And, you know, I've always known who he is, and then when he ran for lieutenant governor, you know, my parents both supported him and hosted some events for him, and then of course he became governor. And so it's interesting, as the governor's families are kind of like a small little fraternity almost.
Interesting, yeah.
So. You know, it's anytime I see Tim Kaine or George Allen or Doug Wilder or Chuck Robb or Linwood Holton. I mean, you know, it's always very nice and spirited. It's almost as if we're distant relations.
Yeah.
Because we've all had a shared experience that we were fortunate enough to experience, but not a whole lot of people have. And so we can kind of connect with each other, you know, the pressure of the position and what, you know, the family obligations as well as, you know, the limitations of the family, because, you know, you're always in the public eye.
Right.
And so, you know, one of the funny stories is, you know, when Governor Kane moved into the mansion, he had a son about my age, Nat, who moved in there. And, you know, there are whispers of, you know, don't do what John did when he was here in the 80s.
You like the case story of...
Exactly. And so I remember when the Canes moved in, and I talked to Nat as a month or two, maybe 3 months after they had moved in, and we had a good discussion. I gave him some pointers.
It's like the older brother's like, listen, bro.
Right.
Here are the mistakes that I made.
Right, right.
This is what you want to do. This is what you don't want to do. Here's where you can push the boundaries. Here's where you can't.
Exactly.
I love that that idea of being almost like initiated into a fraternity. This is a terrible example, but on Saturday Night Live, once you've hosted for five times, you're in like the Five Timers Club. They've done a couple sketches. It's similar but different to that. So at this point in your life, like late 2000s, I know that you spent some time as the assistant to the director of planning and development, mm-hmm. who at the time was Rachel Flynn. That was right around the time where they were building the downtown master plan. What was it like working for her, even just on the downtown master plan? What did you learn?
The downtown master plan was really ramped up in 2007. And that's when mm-hmm. Ross and Sarve and myself, we went to all the meetings and we wrote endlessly about it. And we attended the planning commission meetings, and there was a lot of back and forth, and there were certain positions staked out, and we all appreciated the style that Rachel brought, which was, you know, massive community engagement, mm-hmm. lots of meetings for people to have an opportunity. So if you can't,
they would
make
have the
it,
giant charrettes where you'd show
exactly.
up and you could input and draw with a marker on the paper about.
And what there
you
were
seeing, what
there
you
were
read.
A handful of them. So, you know, if you're on vacation or something and you couldn't make it, you know, there were plenty of opportunities, and somewhere in the middle of the day, at lunchtime, mm-hmm. lunch hour, somewhere at night, somewhere on the weekends. And that really set a process that I think people appreciated, because they felt like they were being heard and their suggestions were at least taken into consideration, even if they weren't applied to the final plan. So that started before I even worked for the city. That
and
was
it sounds
just,
like it was more than
blogger.
Symbolic. It wasn't, we just want to check the box to get public input, but we actually desire for
Absolutely.
You to help
and there,
shape this.
There was some contention, you know, the two biggest points of contention during that process were what to do with MCV West Hospital. It's a mm-hmm. Gothic structure, historic landmark, all that kind of stuff. I think it's on the historic register, but I can't remember. And then the other one was, you know, Rachel really pushed for a riverfront park between Great Shiplock and Rockets, where the Echo Harbor project was scheduled.
Right.
And, you know, that still hasn't happened. It's still a grass field. So maybe that could still happen. I don't know. I don't know what the status of that project is, but those were two big points of contention. And so it took almost 18 months after that to actually get it approved by city council. I think it was approved in early 2009.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the process itself is what it set the standard, I think, for what people expect. And then I'm sure at some point in this conversation, we're going to talk about Shaco baseball, but that was a plan that wasn't developed with input. And it was rolled out and said, here's my plan, take it or leave it. That's not the way the downtown master plan worked
right.
at all.
The spirit of the process.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that makes a difference.
I want to ask about what motivated you to enter public life as an elected official. Because I think all along, both your family and even just some of the work that you were doing before you decided to run for council informed that decision. But what made you go from just being an involved citizen to I am now going to throw my hat in the ring and run for council?
Well, I'll back up a couple of steps, because the reason I got involved in my neighborhood association was four-way stop signs were going up all over the place, and I can't stand four-way stop signs. And, I mean, they serve purposes in certain locations, but they were going up everywhere,
right.
I mean, every block. And so I started showing up at the neighborhood association meeting just to find out, okay, where is this coming from? And I went to a couple of the meetings and I just listened. I didn't say anything. I didn't announce why I was there. I just wanted to see how it worked. And after a couple of meetings, somebody approached me and said, are you interested in joining? I said, no, I just want to find out what's going on and why, find out why all these four ways.
I'm just here for the stop signs.
And they said, well, you seem to be involved and you can sit through these meetings. Do you have any interest in joining the board? And I said, okay. So that's how I joined the board. And then after Mayor Wilder won, that's when I started the blog about around Thanksgiving of 2004.
Okay.
And I just started slowly talking about things that were important to me in the city, and it kind of blossomed from there. And then it's interesting. One of the posts that got me noticed by Norm Leahy, who was writing a blog also at the time, and Jim Bacon, who I consider kind of the godfather of the bloggers. One of the posts that I wrote was commenting on the speakers at a city council meeting when they were discussing nothing other than a Shaco Bottom baseball plan in early 2005. So, you know,
speakers on council or like the public comments?
The public comments. Okay. And it was all kinds of people lined up, and the reasonings and the explanations these people were giving were just so hysterical. And I wasn't making fun of them. I was just listing speaker by speaker what they said.
What's it like to sit behind the desk on council and hear just the variety of public comments?
Well, I mean, that's the value of listening, is you learn things you don't know. It's kind of like going to knock on doors when you're running for office. You don't know who's on the other side of the door, and you don't know what they're going to ask you or what they're going to tell you. So you have to be on your toes. Yeah. So you can learn a lot from listening to the public comments. You're certainly not going to agree all the time. But one of the things that I've noticed in the last 4 years is all of us take notes when people speak. And maybe not every speaker, but you know, if you hear something that resonates, that's a good point, and you write it down in your notes. And I think it's valuable. I wish we had a better system. And I know there's been some talk lately of moving our committee system and our planning commission meetings to the evenings to allow for more people to come after work, or maybe jet out of work.
Because those are open, but they're currently during the day. During work.
Planning commission's at 1:30. Some of the council meetings are during the day. The council committee that I chair starts at 5. But, you know, it just depends on the committee chair. But I think it would be good to set a standard that you do things like that.
Gotcha.
At a time when people can show up.
Right. So you've spent a good amount of time in City Hall. What is City Hall doing well? What needs to be fixed?
You know, when I first got down there in February of 2008, when Mayor Wilder hired me, I was stunned by, you know, after getting up to speed in the first couple of weeks, being very quiet, going to meetings and whatnot, I was stunned at how much of City Hall was working and how much people really wanted to try and do a good job. And I remember thinking to myself, wow, we're not as screwed up as I thought we were. And
but nobody tells those stories of these are all the great things that are happening.
Right. And I mean, I would tell people that, but I don't think they believe me.
Right.
But, you know, the thing that has hurt the city since then is that, you know, you have a lack of leadership at the top, which filters down all the way down to the basement level. And if you don't have leadership that is engaged and you know, present, then people are going to say, you know what, nobody's looking. I'm going to skip out of here this afternoon, or I'm not going to return this call because I don't like the way this person was talking to me. You have to set a standard, not only of showing up, but being, like I said, active, engaged. Wilder used to walk around every now and then and just pop into places. And nothing was wrong. He just...
Just getting some FaceTime.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And knowing that people are engaged... you know, and the boss cares, so I better care.
Right.
Because if that doesn't happen, then there's a disconnect. And you know, one of the things I've done when I was on staff and then two times as a council person, I've ridden with what Public Works used to do, something called Turnaround Day, where you would ride with a crew that's fixing alleys or potholes or whatever. And I did it three times, and I would always ride with an alley crew.
This is when you're in planning or when?
The first one was in 2010, I think. And then I did it again in 13 and 14. Okay. They don't do it anymore. What was interesting is those crews give it to you straight. They don't sugarcoat it. Hmm. They don't politicize it. They're like, look, we're out here trying to do our job. This is what we need. These trucks stink. We don't have this. We need that. It's as simple as that.
Right.
And they are unvarnished and honest, and they want to do their job well. But if they don't feel like they're getting the support, then they can't do their job well. Mm-hmm. And if they can't do their job well, they're going to go somewhere where they feel appreciated. And, you know, slashing budgets, you know, has affected the department. It's affected the morale. And it's not just Public Works. The morale around the city hall has suffered. And that's what happens when you put politics ahead of doing your job and trying to provide what people like you and I expect local government to provide.
Right.
You know, this is not national defense. We don't have to build a Navy or, you know, man airports for safety. You know, we're talking about picking up the trash, plowing the street after we get 12 inches of snow, cutting the grass before your kids disappear in it. It's not hard, but if you pretend it's not a problem or show that you're not involved and don't care much, then it has an effect. And it is not beyond fixing, but it's going to take the right person to fix it.
And how much of that is having the person in office, particularly in the mayor's seat, how much of it is personality versus just structural challenges that are built into the system? Education has been the big thing in the last year, right? Mm-hmm. So it's, I think the most average people are just like, why can't the mayor and school board and city council, why can't they all just work together? And I just wonder how much of that is based on the personalities of the people sitting in the room versus the way that the system is set up structurally.
Well, some of it, you know, some of it's buy-in. You still have to, in politics, especially local politics, you still have to talk to and work with people that you may disagree with 90% of the time.
Right.
So work on the 10%.
Sure.
Or at least keep them open to, you know, the possibility that, okay, this person's still talking to me. We'll try and find common ground, even if it's outside the 10%.
Talking to me, so I still have a chance.
Yeah, exactly. If I've been on council for almost 4 years. I met with the mayor twice. That's not an open door. And, it's unfortunate on many levels, but that's the importance of, you know, making sure that you still try and work with people on issues that you think something can get accomplished. Even if you disagree, find a way to make the disagreement as small a piece of the pie as possible.
Sure. I want to ask about school funding. Mm-hmm. I know that, is the ordinance going through now that you're taking a look at taking 100% of the meals tax?
Is that number wrong? Yeah, it's the proposals that we're considering are putting about 61% of real estate taxes towards school funding and one penny of the meals tax, which is the equivalent of about $5.5 million.
Okay.
Or a combination.
Right. And you can dial down. But I think the question that proposal is after is how do we provide a steady stream of funding to the schools? And I'm wondering how much something like that would help.
It's interesting because what has happened here in Richmond is you've got the mayor who makes remarks like only 11% of the student or 11% of the population goes to Richmond Public Schools. So, you know, we have other needs and that's just too bad. I mean, that's a horrible attitude to take. And what we do know is that, and it's not just on this mayor, I mean, the schools have been neglected since I was a kid.
Right.
And it's not going to get turned around overnight. So the idea for a funding stream is to take the budget contentiousness off the table.
Mm-hmm.
So if the schools know generally what they're going to get every year, if in a good year it might be more, a bad year like 2009 where real estate taxes plummet, you know, everybody suffered.
Right.
So it's not like you're picking on one department. So if you take the budget contentiousness off the table, then in my mind, the discussion focuses on accountability. How do the schools move the needle? If they know they're going to have stable funding for the next 4 to 5 years, let's move the needle and create buy-in from parents, from, you know, people that say, okay, I'm leaving at middle school, and, you know, get the buy-in, get people involved in the PTA, get your schools turned around, be a part of the solution. Don't look just to the pocketbook or the checkbook right. to say, this is going to fix it, because it's not.
Right.
And the city has to do more for workforce development and train adults that have kids in the system now, but as adults, they went through the system and didn't get the education right. back then. So right. it's a really complex situation.
Totally.
That yeah. So if you have one part of the government, i.e. the administration, saying, okay, we're not gonna provide funding stream to schools, and we're gonna fight them on the budget because we need more money for X, Y, and Z over here. Mm-hmm. We want to build a baseball stadium. So if that's the case, then the schools can't move the needle, and you still got parents out there, some parents who, like I said, didn't get the education when they went through the system.
Yeah. I think the funding question is an interesting one to me, because I think it is necessary to get us where we need to be, but it isn't sufficient. Because I think it's bricks and mortar. It's also classroom instruction. And then even just thinking about the worlds that a lot of these folks are living in, when you think about poverty and public safety, yeah. that essentially what we're talking about is, how do you build an environment for a child to thrive in a healthy way? And education is a huge part of that, but it's not the only piece.
It's not. And, you know, education does four things. It lowers poverty, reduces crime, it improves long-term health outcomes, and it promotes economic development. And if you have less crime, then you can reduce your size of your police force accordingly, or just not fill positions as people retire. Right now, we're 36 people short,
right.
and we need them. But in 20 years, we may need 650. If you improve long-term health outcomes and you reduce poverty, then you have less social services case management, people trying to help people up.
Right.
But right now, social services case managers, I mean, they're getting crushed with the caseloads that are unhealthy. Right. And so, you know, and companies aren't going to come to Richmond and locate in Richmond if they don't think the skills are here to,
right.
to you know, work on their floor or in their office. And so, you know, all of that is tied together, which is why you can't have all of this disagreement all the time. I mean, if you look back 2005, Rodney Monroe came in, Mayor Wilder came in, and they made a sustained investment in public safety. They said, we're going to alter the schedules so there are more officers on duty when bad things are happening. We're going to raise the minimum starting pay to be comparable to surrounding localities.
And Rodney Monroe, chief of police.
Yes, yep. yes, chief of police. And they instituted a robust community policing program. Mm-hmm. There were 100 vacancies in 2005, and right now they're 36. When they did those three things, the vacancies in the Richmond Police Department went to zero.
Hmm.
In 2005, there were about, I'm a little off, but there were, I want to say, about 94 murders in 2005. 2006, it was down to 85, 81, mm-hmm. something like that. 2007, it went to 56, and people sat up and said, wait a minute, 56 murders in the city of Richmond? It hadn't been that low in
right.
forever. And then in 2008, it was 32. So the needle got moved because they continued to do what it took, you know. And now we realize how important good community policing is because of what's happened all over the country the last couple of years.
Yep.
And we are lucky to have a department that is trusted in most corners of the community. And that's got to continue. But going back to the schools question, if we don't make that commitment to at least try and move the needle, then I mean, I can tell you right now what's going to happen over the next 4 years if all we want to do is bitch and moan about the money.
Right.
Because nothing's going to get done. More kids aren't going to get educated. More families are going to move to the counties.
Mm-hmm.
and businesses aren't going to locate in the city of Richmond.
Yeah. People always talk about millennials. I'm an old millennial. So I apologize up front, but I sometimes feel like I'm living a case story, right? Like I live in the city, my wife and I live in the city, and like our generation, we're having conversations about what are we going to do when we have kids. Some of my friends are working through this now.
Right.
It's like, oh, elementary school, maybe. Middle school, probably not. And so I feel like there's a ticking clock for me personally of trying to figure out, okay, I want to make a run at this, but I'm not totally sure. So I hope we're able to figure it out.
Well, and that's, you are a case study, because that's exactly whose mind we have to change by investing in the system.
So, and a part of that too is like the talent pipeline, that if the baby boomers are getting older and we need to replace like the quote unquote human capital with a younger generation. And I think there's a relationship between all these things. I want to ask you a question just about business development, because I think that there's a relationship between, I mean, what we were just talking about, essentially like the concentration of urban poverty and creating a great culture here of creativity and a place that's attractive to millennials and businesses. And I'm wondering how you see those two things connecting, or do you?
Well, I do. And you know, what's interesting is there are more people in this city at this time lined up to help the city solve its problems than I've ever seen before. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's an army out there waiting to go. They want to get behind somebody and they want to say, let's go. Let's lead the charge. Let's get involved. You know, I don't know how many people, thousands of people through their church or just their free time or their retired, who deliver Meals on Wheels for Feed More. They volunteer through their church to mentor a child. They get involved in, you know, cleaning up the James River, all those types of things. That's why it's important that this next mayor is engaged and out there and leading. You know, people often say, well, the mayor's got to get everything turned around and focus on the day-to-day. The chief administrative officer runs the day-to-day operations of the city. The mayor's the one who needs to be out there really working with rallying these people. Okay, your group, let's focus. If this is what you're interested in, here, we're going to connect you with these people, and they're going to help you and get motivated and involved. We would very greatly benefit if we had a leader who kind of tapped into that angst of people wanting to volunteer and help make the city better, because it's free help.
Right. Yeah, I love that. I mean, there's something, because I think you're right that there is a critical mass of people in Richmond that are engaged, that want to help and see this place become what it can be. And I think you're right that there's a part of the mayoral role that is symbolic, where it's, do you have the ability to inspire? Can you engage people? Do you have the soft skills to listen to what somebody's interested in and connect them to that thing? So we need to wrap up here in just a minute.
Okay.
I've got five final questions for you.
Uh-oh.
Are you ready to play a quick lightning round with me, Councilman Jonathan Beliles?
Yes, I am.
Question number one. You are a sports fan.
Yes.
And according to your website, you are into Formula One racing.
True.
What do you enjoy about Formula One?
Just, I don't know. It's the speed. It's the danger. It's watching. And don't get me wrong, I love all sports. You know, I love soccer. I love British soccer. You know, I've had, up until this year, since I can't go to any games, you know, I've had season tickets to UVA football for 20 some years. So, you know, it doesn't matter the sport. But one of the things that I love about Formula One is, you know, it's like a chess match going 200 miles an hour. And it's true with any motorsport, really.
Whoa, interesting.
It's you going around the track, and it may take you two laps around the track to figure out where you're stronger than the guy right in front of you.
Right.
And then it may take you another couple laps to figure out where your best chance to pass is, and then you got to pull it off without wrecking one or both of you. And so it's a strategic, and most sports are strategic, but this one just happens to be rolling along
in a race car 200 miles an hour.
Yeah.
Got it. Question the second. You enjoy cooking?
I do.
What is one dish that you like to cook and why?
First one that comes to mind is a cucumber cilantro salad.
Ooh.
That is fantastic on really hot days because it's cold and got a little zing to it. And then it's just, you know, whatever you want to add to the salad. It's I usually put red onions and feta in there. So it's kind of like, it's similar to a Greek salad, but it's different.
Yep. And
it's just something I found in a magazine.
That sounds great.
I'll send you the recipe.
Yeah, I'll give it a shot. I'll give it a shot. Question the third. The West Hampton Theater. I loved it. I only went twice. I feel like it was when my parents got divorced and that I'm blaming myself that I didn't go enough. So is it my fault that the West Hampton Theater had to go away?
No, they hadn't been producing much, if any, of a profit for a long time. So
yeah.
The theater that rented the building or owned the building knew that the writing was on the wall. It's just a question of when.
Yeah, I still blame myself, though. Question the fourth. It is about your hair. You've got great hair.
Thank you.
Is it natural or do you use product?
It's natural.
It's natural.
It is.
It's impressive.
Thank you.
You had a beard for a little while.
I did. I grew one at the end of my first year on council for about 6 months.
That was legit. It was a good beard.
It was. I, you know, we didn't have any meetings over the Christmas holiday, and so I didn't shave at all. We had about 2.5 weeks or so, and I just didn't shave.
All right, final question. John Belisles, you're a mayoral candidate, and there's somebody on the other side of this recording. I want you to speak directly to them. Why should that person vote for you for mayor?
Well, this is an important election, probably the most important one in Richmond in my lifetime, as far as what kind of city are we going to be and where are we going to go. Like I mentioned earlier, we've got an army of people willing to help. We've got a lot of things that are going right in the city. But one of the things that's not going well is local government and the leadership of local government. We need a mayor who's going to, A, knows the city up and down, back and forwards. We need somebody who is a listener, because it's been clear in recent years that thinking that you have all the answers does not provide a solution. And if you have somebody that listens and somebody that makes good ideas better, like the RVA Street Art Festival example, then you get a better product. We need a better city. And the thing I'll say is this, in terms of my style, is back in the 90s, I think it was, may have even started in the 80s, but when Boeing was developing their 777 airliner, the engineers designed the plane, but they didn't go and build it based on what the engineers said. They took the plans all over the world to different airports, to different cultures, to different people, and they let everybody that was going to touch a plane tell them how to improve it. So all over the world, they talked to pilots, they talked to baggage handlers, they talked to the people that, you know, load up the food service on turnaround. They talked to the gas people, they talked to the mechanics, and everybody had a hand in designing that plane. So they had a pretty good plane on paper.
Right.
But they made it better by talking to the people that say, tell us how you can do your job better and we'll make design changes. And that's why it's not the biggest plane in the world, but it is considered you know, pretty much the best plane in the world.
Right.
And you know, it's only been in service, I think, for, I don't know, 15 years maybe. But it's that kind of input and feedback that local government should be soliciting from the citizens. And that's the kind of mayor I'll be, because, you know, you can't get a plane off the ground by yourself. I mean, you need people to build it. You need people to service it. And if I wouldn't want to be on a plane that doesn't have other people's input and other people helping out. And that's what we need.
Yeah. John Belisles, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun.
This was a lot of fun. Best of luck to you.
Thanks.
For more information about John's candidacy for mayor, you can check out johnbelislesformayor.com. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes and lots of other podcast places. Our theme is by No BS Brass, and Chris Payne is that feeling you get when you wear your hoodie for the first time in the fall.
It's familiar. It's comfortable. It's assuring. Thanks for listening.